I'm Dr. Lan Lan Smith, Editor-in-Chief of The Lancet Hematology, and I'm very pleased to be joined today by Dr. Sumit Gupta, an Associate Professor and Oncologist at the Hospital for Sick Children in Toronto, Canada, specializing in the treatment and care of children, adolescents, and young adults with hematological malignancies, particularly those with acute lymphocytic leukemia. So today we're going to be talking about a paper that Professor Gupta has just published with The Lancet Hematology, looking at whether race and ethnic disparities have an effect on the survival outcomes of children and young adults with acute lymphocytic leukemia. Can you please tell us a little about the background of your study?
Sure, and thank you for the opportunity to talk about the study, Dr. Smith. So, you know, we've been very lucky in our treatment of children with acute lymphoblastic leukemia, or ALL, in that we have seen remarkable improvements in survival over the last decades, and those improvements have continued to happen over the last 10 or 20 years as well. So, at the same time, I think all of us have always known, but have become even more aware over the last few years about the disparities in health that our populations around the world experience as a result of racial or ethnic disparities. So our question was whether those disparities that we see in other areas of medicine are also seen in childhood ALL as well. There have been previous studies that have looked at this, but not in several decades. And a lot of those studies also made the assumption that race and ethnicity-based disparities were really just proxies for either differences in disease biology that might differ across those categories of patients, or by disparities in socioeconomic status across those patients as well. So really we had two real objectives. One was to look at whether these race and ethnicity-based disparities existed still in the context of modern ALL therapy that, as I said, is generally very successful. But also, if they did exist, we wanted to drill down to the extent that we could to see whether this was just due to disparities in socioeconomic factors or biologic disease factors, or whether there was something else going on in addition to those two factors.
Yeah, two really important questions. And it is so, we're learning so much now about the health disparities, and it's a really important thing to address. So how did you go about answering these two questions?
So we used data from the Children's Oncology Group, which is a cooperative trial group, the largest cooperative trial group that runs studies for children with cancer globally. And so we took the last sort of 8 or 9 clinical trials of children with acute lymphoblastic leukemia, or ALL. And we're lucky in that in the course of running these trials, we end up with a very large data set of literally tens of thousands of children with ALL, relatively detailed data about the type of ALL that they have, as well as how they did ultimately in terms of whether their leukemia came back or relapsed and whether they survived or not. So there are, within this large data set, also some relatively crude, admittedly, but nonetheless data on both the race, ethnicity of most of these patients, a proxy for their socioeconomic status, which is really just their insurance status. We can talk more about that as well. And the traditional disease prognosticators that we all sort of who treat ALL are very familiar with: the type of ALL they had, the cytogenetics of that ALL, how old the child was, whether the ALL involved the central nervous system, et cetera, et cetera. And so what we did was actually relatively simple methodologically. First of all, we just categorized these patients by their race and ethnicity and looked at whether their outcomes differed. But then we also built several different multivariable models to see, again, whether that disparity was going to be explained by socioeconomic status, again, here insurance status, disease biology predictors, or both. And so we essentially just took that race and ethnicity variable and then just built various multivariable models where we just sequentially added in all the disease prognosticators or socioeconomic status, again, insurance status, or both, to see whether the disparities that we were seeing either attenuated or did not when we added those other factors in.
Yeah, like it's a simple methodology, but because you had all that data, that gives you a lot of calculating power, doesn't it? And that's one of the great things about these collaborative groups, that we can use the data from these trials the best way possible. So, I mean,
absolutely.
Yeah, please tell us, what does your study show?
Yeah, so, you know, again, this was a cohort of over 21,000 children who had race and ethnicity data available and insurance status available as well. And so what we showed, unfortunately, but probably not too surprisingly to most of the listeners and the readers, it was that there were race and ethnicity-based disparities in outcome. So what we saw was that non-Hispanic white children and non-Hispanic Asian children had the best outcomes, whereas non-Hispanic Black children, Hispanic children, and the remainder of categories of race and ethnicity that we unfortunately had to combine because of sample size and just call non-Hispanic other, which is not the best term, but the best one that we could use, those three groups of children had inferior outcomes. Now, that's not to say that their outcomes were bad. The majority of those children were still cured of their ALL, but just not to the same rate as non-Hispanic white or non-Hispanic Asian children. So just to put some numbers on that, for example, so, you know, 5-year event-free survival amongst non-Hispanic white children, for example, was 87.4%, whereas among Hispanic patients, it was approximately 82.8%. So, you know, on one hand, you could say, oh, both groups of children are doing quite well, which is absolutely true. And again, a marker of all the great research that's come before this. But on the other hand, that's still a pretty substantial difference. And so then, of course, our next question was, why are we seeing that?
Yeah, that's... And were you able to elucidate why you're seeing that?
Yeah, I think we made some progress in at least getting some directions to follow in the future as well. So remember that studies in the past had really made the assumption or hypothesized that these disparities, which again existed in the past as well, were due to imbalances in disease prognosticators or socioeconomic status or both, right? And so we know, for example, that there are some types of high-risk ALL, some genetic subtypes, for example, that are more common in, say, children of Hispanic ethnicity than in other racial or Hispanic or ethnic groups. And so what we found was actually we found very interesting in that there were different patterns of attenuation depending on which group we looked at. So, for example, when we looked at the increased risk faced by Hispanic children with ALL, when we added both disease prognosticators and socioeconomic status by virtue of insurance status into the model, we found that there was an attenuation in that increased risk, but a partial attenuation. So, you know, those two concepts of disease prognosticators and insurance status did account for some of that risk, but not all of it. By contrast, when we looked at the increased risk faced by Black children, non-Hispanic Black children, there was actually very little attenuation when we accounted for both disease prognosticators and for insurance status, suggesting that there, especially in children of Black race, there is something else going on there in addition to those factors.
Yeah, that'll be really interesting to try to find out what that is. I guess another question that just popped into my head now was, in when you used race then ethnicity in your study, were these self-reported by the patients and their families or determined by another means? Because that's a big question these days as well, isn't it?
That's an excellent, excellent question. And in fact, one of our limitations. So ideally, these data are supposed to be obtained by self-report. We have no way of knowing how often that was the case. So, you know, the data is submitted to and entered by clinical research associates across the 200 plus institutions that participate in children's oncology group trials. And so ideally, each one of those institutions would have asked families, you know, to self-identify their race and ethnicity, and that data would be in the chart, and the CRA would have uploaded that data and recorded it into the clinical report forms. Now, how often that happened versus, you know, how often someone made a snap judgment based on their perception of the patient and or the family, we have no way of knowing. You know, there are two thoughts that have occurred to us when discussing this limitation. One is that, and I'm sure we'll talk about potential mechanisms going forward, but, you know, depending on the mechanism, how other people perceive you may be just as important or even more important than how you perceive yourself, depending on the mechanism, of course, right? The second point is that there are actually substantial efforts, I think, not just within the Children's Oncology Group, but other places as well, to really drill down on improving the quality of our collection of this type of data going forward. You could also argue that although these categories that we used based on retrospective data for race and ethnicity are relatively traditional in the American context, they are still quite crude, right? They lump pretty heterogeneous populations within categories. And, you know, our study also included children from Canada, Australia, and New Zealand as well. And those racial and ethnic categories may not be as appropriate for populations, specific populations in those countries as well. So for example, you know, First Nations patients in Canada and Aboriginal patients in Australia, that categorization doesn't necessarily make sense either. So there are certainly limitations that go along with this sort of relatively crude way of categorizing race and ethnicity. But in the end, it's important that despite that crudeness, there are substantial disparities that we are able to demonstrate.
Yes, and showing that this hasn't changed despite the treatment techniques really improving over the years and being more aware that these issues are happening. So another quite interesting finding that you saw in your paper was that you saw significant differences for survival outcomes for patients with B-cell ALL, but not for those with T-cell ALL. Can you hypothesize a little bit about why this is so?
Yeah, so that was one of our most surprising findings. And it's a nice segue into trying to figure out what the mechanisms are here, right? So if it's not, you know, entirely disease prognosticators and it's not entirely insurance status, what else could it be? And you know, it's important to acknowledge that our data are not capable of answering that question 100%, right? And there's certainly the possibility that we didn't account for all the disease prognosticators. And we certainly, you know, insurance status is a very, very imperfect proxy of socioeconomic status. So those things are almost certainly still in play in some effect. But, you know, the B cell versus T cell difference in results is very fascinating, actually, because the treatment is very similar and delivered by the same healthcare teams in the same hospital. So you wouldn't expect that there would be a difference. One of the main differences between BALL and TALL outcomes is that TALL tends to relapse much earlier than BALL, and we showed that in our cohort as well. ALL treatment is generally comprised of, you know, a 8 to 12 month period of higher intensity treatment, followed by a prolonged 2 to 3 year period that we call maintenance, which is low intensity therapy, you know, mainly just oral anti-metabolite therapy that you're taking at home as pills. Great work by other colleagues like Dr. Smita Bhatia have shown that adherence during maintenance is really important. But if T-cell ALL relapses much earlier, one might hypothesize that the role of maintenance is more important in BALL relative to TALL. So one of the things that occurred to us and a focus of ongoing investigation is, should we be looking at mechanisms at play within maintenance itself as a focus going forward, right? Not just adherence, although we know that's really important, but could the quality of care differ, you know, between these populations in maintenance, right? Like, are patients of different races and ethnicities getting the same number of visits, the same type of visits, the same explanation, the same monitoring of their counts, the same dose adjustments, you know, because all of those things may have an impact. The other hypothesis, and this is totally speculative, I should be very upfront, but, you know, a core tenet of therapy during maintenance is to adjust the dosage of your anti-metabolite therapy to a patient's neutrophil count. Well, we know very well from other studies that baseline neutrophil counts vary between people of race and ethnicity, and that both children and adults who are Black tend to have, on average, lower baseline neutrophils than other races and ethnicities, which are perfectly normal for that population, right? But so are we then adjusting to normal ranges or ranges that are based in majority populations instead of minority populations? Again, that's totally speculation, but it is another hypothesis there as well. And I think, you know, both of those, whether the care and maintenance matters or differs between these populations, and whether we're adjusting to the right, say, normative value in these populations across populations, I think both speak to this concept that I think we've all gotten very familiar with of systemic racism, which doesn't mean that, you know, the individual providers taking care of these children are prone to racism necessarily, but that these systems are designed more with the needs of a certain population in mind on average than another. And those could manifest in all sorts of way. You know, when we were discussing this within our study team, we as pediatric oncologists think of ourselves as providing exquisite care, right? Like, we all got into this to be able to, I think we think that a certain type of person goes into pediatric oncology, right? Who is all in on trying to give as great care as possible to our populations. And you know, I'm as biased as the next person when it comes to pediatric oncology. I really think that's true. But I think it's also probably a little bit naive of us to think that our corner of medicine isn't prone to the same types of biases and systemic issues that every other part of medicine and, you know, potentially society in general is prone to as well.
I mean, the great thing that I'm hearing here is that these are two areas where we can actually enact change and monitor. So there, it's not beyond the realms to look further into this and potentially improve outcomes for these populations as well, which is really, really helpful. I mean, I was going to ask you a little bit about the implications of your findings, but I think we've covered it quite well there, unless you've got any other insights that you would like to add?
Yeah, no, I think I just emphasize what you just said there, and that, you know, what we have done in this paper, I think, is describe with great detail that these disparities exist and to give some suggestions on what some mechanisms might be. The ultimate goal, of course, has to be to understand the mechanisms behind these disparities, not for the sake of just understanding them, but so interventions can be put into place that actually help us mitigate these disparities. And so, you know, we view this paper as a foundation for both our study team and for multiple other study teams, hopefully, to take these now and to say, okay, well, we're going to, you know, look at this mechanism and not just how much of that is responsible for this type of disparity, but what can we do to address it? And as we've both sort of noted, I think there's lots that can be done there. It's just a challenge to go from describing to understanding to intervening.
Yeah, so in the ideal world, if you had unlimited resources, what sort of would your ideal prospective study look like for the future?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. Something that moves along that spectrum, but does each of those steps really, really well, right? So I would love to have, not just me, but my colleagues as well and many others, you know, really detailed information on not just, you know, these crude levels of or crude categorizations of race and ethnicity, but much more detailed ones. Love to have a variety of socioeconomic status type of data, not just something crude like insurance status, right? Maybe even genetic ancestry data, right? Some great colleagues in other institutions like St. Jude's have looked at genetic ancestry-based differences. And I think putting all of these together and then coming up with, you know, specific study designs to look at specific of these mechanisms is going to be crucial. But then again, always aiming for that intervention. And I think that is starting to happen, right? That's not just a wish of mine, but, you know, there are ongoing studies for right now, for example, that are looking at, you know, transportation and grocery interventions for children with household material hardship. There's some great work being led out of the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute by Dr. Kira Bona and others, you know, ongoing trials. She made the joke once where, you know, at some point maybe we'll have a primary disparities study that has a correlative therapeutic aim instead of a therapeutic study that has a correlative disparities aim, right? But I think, you know, joking aside, I think we are starting to move in that direction.
Yeah, and it'd be great also to have more input from the families as well, that because so much of this research at the moment is like academic driven, but getting those who are most impacted involved as well would be really, really useful, I think. So.
Absolutely. We in the Children's Oncology Group Acute Lymphoblastic Leukemia Committee, we have on the basis of these data sort of established a disparities working group and are actively trying to bring in as many sort of parent and patient representatives to try to mirror the diversity of the population that we serve.
Well, thank you so much for talking to us about this very interesting study. And I'm so glad that we got to publish it in The Lancet Hematology. So, and for all of those who are out there listening, I highly recommend that you go read the entire paper yourself to see all the details. So thank you again so much for joining us today, Dr. Gupta.
Thanks very much, Dr. Smith. It was a great experience, and I'm very thankful for the opportunity to disseminate this work further.